Well, good evening and welcome to the Filson Historical Society. I'm Mark Wetherington, Director, and I'm delighted to see you have chosen to join us tonight for what I know is going to be a very, very interesting program based on a very good book. And I hope you'll pick up a copy. Before I introduce our speaker, let me remind you that our mission is to collect, preserve, and tell the significant stories of Kentucky and the Ohio Valley region's history and culture. And the African-American story is certainly one of the significant stories. So our collections are really strong in this area, and we've had a lot of people come through and do research here over the years. So we would appreciate you remembering that and coming back and joining us again. And we appreciate your support in that area as well. Our speaker tonight, Pelham McDaniels III, has a very interesting background. So I'm going to give you the dust jacket introduction, and then give you the conversation, part of the conversation we had, but not all of it. And this is the dust jacket part. Pelham McDaniels III is the faculty curator of African American collections and assistant professor of African American studies at Emory University. He received a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship for the Prince of Jockeys. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, that's that part. Pelham was born in San Jose, and before he received his PhD and became a professor, he played professional football. And you might be able to tell that he played defensive end for the Kansas City Chiefs from 1992 to 1998. And 1999 to 2000, he played with the Atlanta Falcons, which I think it's the first time I've introduced a professor in history who was a professional football player. So I'm just kind of stringing this along a little bit. But then after he did all that, he wanted an even bigger challenge. So he decided to try for a PhD at Emory University, and he succeeded there as well. He taught in Kansas City for 5 years and has been at Emory, I think, now for 2 years in this position, which is a very interesting position, and they have amassed a really strong African-American research collection at Emory. So, Professor McDaniels.
Good evening, everyone. That was a very good introduction, Mark. It's very difficult sometimes for people to put those words together, those ideas, you know, football and academia. And so I decided to go back to graduate school when I was done playing football, and my career ended abruptly. I was diagnosed with blood clots in my lungs after a preseason game in Japan. And so my wife and I, you know, a good friend, Derek Thomas, had died of a blood clot the same year, and so we decided that it was time for me to stop playing. And because we hadn't had children yet, the things that we wanted to accomplish post-retirement were now very close as opposed to kind of out there in 5 or 10 years. So we decided that was enough. And so at the end of that season, I retired and applied to graduate school at Emory, and the only graduate school I applied to. And my mentor, who's passed away, Rudolph Byrd, the book is dedicated to him. He was a really good friend, mentor, and a guide on this new journey in my life as an academic. And so it was only appropriate that I dedicate the book to him. So as for the project, this was a 10-year odyssey. This was the first chapter of my dissertation, and I'll just put it in perspective for you. After playing professional football for 10 years and being a college athlete and, of course, playing in high school, I had these questions about African-American men playing football, boys playing football, sports in general. And so those questions were, I would say, in the back of my mind while I was playing and interacting with other players who seemed to have only one thing on their minds, which was football. There was nothing else beyond that that they imagined, that they prepared for, because again, for those of you who don't know this, but the average career of a professional football player is only 3.5 years. And that might be pushing it. And the studies that I've read and some that have been conveyed have said, basically, if you have a degree, you'll play 7 years. And so those that have some education and have graduated from college will play an average of 7 years in the NFL. So I went beyond the average plus. But I guess the point is that the research question of what has been the impact of black athletes on 20th century America is the question I had when I started my graduate program. And that's a very broad question. You know, there's a lot of opportunities to kind of deconstruct that. But I had to look at the 19th century. I had to understand what the world was like prior to the 20th century, prior to Jack Johnson, prior to Joe Louis and Jesse Owens, and of course Jackie Robinson. What did the world look like? And what were sports, how were sports defined? And what were the most popular sports of the day? And so Isaac Murphy's name popped up every so often. And whether I was reading someone's anthology, a book about sports, David Wiggins, you know, he has a chapter about Isaac Murphy, very thin chapter, but still Murphy's represented. You look at older texts by Edwin Bancroft Henderson in 1930, he mentions Isaac Murphy. James Weldon Johnson in Black Manhattan, his kind of treatise of New York, mentions the jockey. And so jockeys were very important to these individuals of the early part of the 20th century, so I had to figure out why they were so important. What made them attractive to these intellectuals and some of the historians working on this in the 20th century? And so I started looking up Isaac Murphy. And what I discovered was, here was someone who supposedly was one of the greatest jockeys in American history, but we had not really accounted for his life. We accounted for his racing. We accounted for these different qualities and attributes of, you know, being an elegant specimen of manhood. He was an honest jockey. He never pulled a horse. But his life, his world that he lived in, the world he grew up in, the community that shaped his character and his identity, it was never disclosed. It was never pursued. And so when I did work on Joe Louis and did work on Jackie Robinson and even Jesse Owens, there was an element connected to family that was a very important part of them having the capacity to do ultimately what they do, how we remember them in history. So I assumed that surely Murphy must have a community. Surely his mother or father may have influenced his, you know, his character, because it's been demonstrated with these other individuals that that was a big part of shaping who they were, their identities. And so began my quest. And I must tell you that it was troublesome, because Murphy didn't have any papers. At least I haven't been able to find that nice big box in someone's attic. I haven't found that yet. But we do have his voice. And so my quest was to look for Isaac Murphy's voice. That's all I had to go on. What was published prior in David Wiggins' work, it was recycled material. Things that other people had written about, things that Frank Borees had recorded in the 1960s related to Murphy and his induction into the Hall of Fame. And so I was really mining something totally new. I was digging in everything. I was here looking through C.C. Morgan's, you know, records and exporting wool and hemp to Kansas City. I was in Frankfurt looking through, you know, tax documents. I was everywhere, especially in the state of Kentucky. And so 7 years later, I had compiled 8 boxes of materials, whether tax records, newspaper clippings, photographs of people who you'll see some of them this evening. And then I had to stitch together some kind of a narrative, some way in which to tell the story that I thought was worth 10 years of my life. And so I want to begin with reading you the epilogue, which helps frame, really, I think, how biographies help us understand not only the world in which these individuals, they live and they come from, but in some ways understand, you know, why a life is important to study. Okay, so if you have the book, it's on page 410. Putting a life into perspective in a way that is not only meaningful but also revealing of the choices and decisions made in the context of events, intended or otherwise, can be a difficult proposition. This is especially true when there are no personal papers or archives to consult. In this case, gathering the threads, shards, and jagged pieces of a life can be a painstaking task. Biography involves the exploration and clarification of the past in ways that may not fit traditional means of writing historical narratives. Revealing the world into which a person is born, lives, and eventually dies requires an interdisciplinary approach that utilizes various sources and analytical methods to draw conclusions. Invariably, the intent is to explore and understand the multitude of factors responsible for shaping the individual the biographer has deemed captivating and worthy of a commitment of time, resources, and energy. The biographer's mandate is to leave little doubt in the minds of the readers. The life of Isaac Burns Murphy followed the contours of American history. He was born during slavery and died at the beginning of Jim Crow segregation, one of the many crossroads in America's social, economic, and political development. He was raised in a community that took seriously the promises of the Declaration of Independence, and Isaac's achievements were a testament to Black Lexington's commitment to its future, as demonstrated by his commitments to its children. Through the efforts of teachers, ministers, and common folk, Isaac understood that his own achievement was a sign of the community's progress and advancement. Isaac knew that he represented the people he came from, and he honored his past by remaining a part of the Lexington community. Lucy Murphy became an example of Black womanhood that challenged many popular notions of who could claim to be a lady. Educated, beautiful, and a key component of Isaac's success, Lucy helped shape the man who would be identified as an elegant specimen of manhood. Both Isaac and Lucy were instrumental in the elevating the Black professional jockey to an occupation that was considered the equal of a doctor or lawyer. It is clear that they had a great impact on both their friends and outside observers who viewed Murphy as the quintessential jockey whose legendary status grew with every victory, every quote published, and every dignified likeness produced for public consumption. So my job was to try to take all that information, the stuff that I pulled together in those 8 boxes, and create something for you, the reader, and so also for the general public. Because again, this is someone who, especially in Kentucky, and I want to say in Louisville has a significance. What's in front of you right now is the public scholarship aspect of this, meaning that I wanted to produce something. This 500-page book will be for the brave soul. But an exhibition like this, anyone can participate in. And so the exhibitions are for the 80-80, as I say. It's an intergenerational conversation. So I'm going to use this as my means to present this evening. Okay. So in talking about Murphy, I've already read through that epilogue, and I'm sorry if it's too small to read. I'll paraphrase some of this and read some of the other panels. Murphy's life is something that is, it's both compelling, but it's also confusing. It's confusing because of the time period in which he lives. Race confounds us in different ways. It, in some ways, is clearly understood why we use race to identify the differences amongst people. But then at different instances, it doesn't make sense, especially as it relates to the children born out of different relations and how those children are then sold, thinking of slavery, thinking about children who are considered mulatto, quadroon, so on and so forth. Murphy's world was something that had to be recognized as both a something that was considered static, but also evolving. 1861 is when he was born, and we understand what happens in 1861 as it relates to the Civil War. But coming out of that 1861 and coming out of the war, the world was changing for everyone. Whether you wanted it to or not, it was going to change. And so this idea of the life of Isaac Burns Murphy takes into account all the different changes happening, not only in his world, but the world that he lived in, the United States and in Kentucky. The roots section of the book in the beginning discusses Kentucky. You know, Kentucky was the westernmost county of Virginia at one point before it became populated by not just the Second Sons, but frontiersmen, explorers, people looking to get land, people who were owed land, and people who wanted a new life for themselves, and also people who were brought over to help clear those lands and make them fertile and make them prosperous. The root section also deals with the ideas that were circulated and generated by people like Frederick Douglass, who, you know, along with Abraham Lincoln, at one point they agreed upon that slavery was not based on, you know, this idea that it was right, it was based on might, who had the power. But then someone had to wrestle that power away, and it would have to be the Union. Thinking about horse racing in the bluegrass. Now, most of you know this story. I think you are aware of, you know, the development of horse racing had a lot to do with the breed, creating the better breed of horse, because this was the far west. The far, far west was out to California. And if you produce a breed that can go for distances beyond where you're at, that's a better horse to have, as opposed to the sprinter who would need more provisions. And so the development of horses, and you have people like, again, think about John Breckinridge, John Wesley Hunt. You all know the first millionaire west of the Allegheny, right? John Henry Clay, Willa Viley, Elijah Warfield, and Robert Atchison Alexander, who I still think is a fascinating character. Do you all know him? Alexander had Woodford County. He had the model horse farm as it relates to having tracks for trotters, the equestrian horses, steeplechase, and the thoroughbreds. The one thing I learned about Alexander in this research, and Aristides, we all know Aristides, and you know the horse Asteroid. Okay, so the trainer for Asteroid and the trainer for Aristides was? Nope. Who was the trainer? See, I'm going to pick your brains like students tonight. The trainer for Aristides and for Asteroid, the famous Asteroid, Ansel Williamson. Does that name ring a bell? Ansel Williamson was loaned to Robert Atchison Alexander from Richard Keene. Now, part of this discussion about horse racing in the Civil War is going to bring us back to the reality that is that at the bottom right here, we have to reconcile the fact that these trainers and jockeys were commodities just like the horses. Ansel Williamson was born a slave in Alabama in the 1830s, I believe. He was raced for a Goldsby, which was out of Selma, Alabama. And at the Louisiana races, Richard Keene purchased Ansel Williamson from Goldsby. And it was because he had done such a great job on the great horse Brown Dick. So he wins on Brown Dick. He is purchased from Richard Keene. Richard Keene brings him up to Kentucky. Robert Atchison Alexander is in need of a trainer, so he's loaned to him. So the story continues to unfold. It's a very interesting story. And then over time, when freedom comes, then Ansel Williamson then goes to work for, I can't remember his name right now, owns Aristides. It's not E.J. Baldwin. It'll come. So the linkages between horse racing, slavery, and the development of the black jockey and trainer are so tied together. And let's read from here, right here. In generating revenue for their masters, these men created value for themselves and increased their reputations as quality slaves. This was Ansel Williamson. Ironically, like the horses they rode to victory, even the most successful African-American jockeys of the antebellum period were merely commodities to be bought and sold. So all these things are tied together, but we've never really talked about them openly and pulled them apart. So the Civil War, of course, is another catalyst for horse racing's development beyond what it was prior. So before the Civil War, it was more or less a genteel type of occupation, if not leisure time. It was something that very wealthy men could do because they had the wealth to do it, but they also were interested in developing the horse as a, you know, as a staple. As the nation grew, the need for horses and transportation also followed suit. So after the Civil War, you have a need to develop jockeys that could actually help develop this industry further. 1861, Isaac Murphy is born. This might be the only document that ties him to David Tanner's farm out in Clark County. And that highlighted area just says, black boy, January 6th. Gives no name, his mother, just black baby boy. And this was the only record I could find of any child born on David Tanner's farm between 1859 and 1862. So could be not. But again, going back to the records that have already been, you know, the articles that have been written and the different narratives that have been produced, and even the obituary written by L.P. Tarleton in 1896 with regards to Murphy, this is as close as we're going to get to actually having something recording his birth. As you know, there were no birth certificates for slaves. Children born, they had no birth certificates. Jerry Skillman, who has been misrepresented, of course, historically, was Isaac Murphy's father. Some record him as being captured by Confederates and dying in a Confederate prison. Jerry Skillman's story is something I'm looking forward to having someone else work on, because he was part of the 114th Colored Infantry that went to St. Petersburg and was absorbed into the 25th Corps, which actually went in to Richmond and St. Petersburg. And at the end of the war, these men were sent down to the Rio Grande. One of the things I learned about this story is that they were all gathered up, all the different regiments, and they were sent on the ship to the Rio Grande with half rations and half supplies. A number of them died of scurvy on the way, and they contracted tuberculosis, and you know, their numbers were thinned out. Those that survived the Rio Grande became Buffalo Soldiers, but some of them had lost to history. Jerry Skillman, on the other hand, he contracted what they called yellow fever and died at Camp Nelson, and is buried in Camp Nelson. Right here where it says, sometime before June 24th, 1864, Skillman left Bourbon County. There is a set of brothers who own property in Bourbon County and in outside Winchester. They grew hemp. And so they had hemp farms. And Jerry and Charles Skillman, as they registered for the Union Army, they're claiming this is what they did for a living. You know, they worked on a farm. They were laborers. At the bottom here, at some point, Private Skillman of the 114th Infantry would change his name to Burns. And I say probably in an effort to make it more difficult for his owner to find him among the more than 1,500 black recruits from Kentucky who volunteered that June. And sometimes we can never know why they changed their names. It's a name that they adopt. Maybe it was their father's name, but it's very difficult sometimes to figure out why these people would change their names. You know, so there are tons of freemen because they took on that moniker because they were free men. But someone like Jerry Burns or Jerry Skillman, it's hard to track. The good thing is that with other documents, we can find him in America Murphy, because she claims him as her husband. And it says both Skillman and Burns. And so I'm looking for pension records, looking for different documents. I can find America Murphy with Jerry Skillman and Jerry Burns. Camp Nelson, now you all know where that is. It's a cemetery, it's a federal. Camp Nelson's an interesting place, especially as it relates to John G. Fee, the founder of Berea College. And he comes in and really does a great job of trying to educate these new free black people. And even during the war, when the soldiers were being mustered in, part of the deal was that their families could also come to Camp Nelson, their wives and their children, and be protected. There are different depositions that you'll find in some of the federal documents that, you know, some of the owners of these men who ran away to join the Union forces, they actually held their families hostage. Well, they owned them, right? But what they did to them because the fathers left is also reprehensible, and it's been recorded. And I won't go into detail. You'll read that in the book. But the Camp Nelson experience is also something I think is worth understanding. So not only, you'll see pictures, these are the cabins that a number of the families stayed in, lived in. These are classrooms, and they had them outdoors because there were so many people there. And then this is another group of children and adults who lived in almost like dormitories. These were the houses for the families where they actually, the soldiers' wives and their children, and these were, you know, unattached people who eventually made their way to Camp Nelson. And so thinking of the community, so in the postbellum period, prior to the Civil War, the black population in Lexington was around 3,500. Post-Civil War, it doubled. It was 7,000 based on the 1870 census. People like James Monroe, E. Bell Mitchell, who taught at Berea College, who graduated from Berea College but taught at Camp Nelson, they would head up the education system prior to the American Missionary Society, American Missionary Association coming into Lexington. So they started teaching out of churches, out of different buildings that were purchased by different community leaders. He's not in this picture over here, but Henry Britton, the father of Julia Britton, who was the grandmother of Benjamin Mays, was one of the barbers in Lexington, and he was what we call a race barber. And a race barber was a person, a person who had a business. Anyone who was a race designated, had a race designated business, he wasn't necessarily servicing only black men, he was servicing white men. And so that was because that they were accustomed to having a particular barber. If they serviced black men, they would no longer have the opportunity to make the income that they were accustomed to. He was a free man during slavery, Henry, what did I say his name was? Henry Britton. So Henry Britton, Henry Scroggins, and these men right here helped create the Colored Fair Association. The Colored Fair Association was founded in 1869 at the Frankfurt, in Frankfurt at the Kentucky Historical Society. There's actually the ledger that they kept for 6 years is still available. I want to read something from the Louisville Convention in 1869. So one of the most impressive demonstrations of the emerging power of this community occurred in the summer of 1869. Again, this is on page 139 if you have the book, you want to mark this. On July 14th in Louisville, Kentucky, more than 2,000 people jammed the streets between 4th and Jefferson near the Benson Theater to attend the Colored Education Convention. The stifling 100-degree temperature did not deter those concerned about the future of their children and the race from attending one of the most important public meetings held in postbellum Kentucky. The standing-room-only crowd was anxiously anticipating the speechifying of prominent guests from around the country, including the Reverend John G. Fee, black Civil War veteran and civil rights activist Martin Delaney, and distinguished black representative of the federal government, John Mercer Langston. At 2 o'clock that afternoon, one of the main organizers, Colonel Benjamin Runkel of the Freedmen's Bureau, addressed the impressive crowd, and I quote, "You have come up through oppression, darkness, and slavery to civil liberty," he began, and you are yet to be respected by all the good people of this country. Gathered together as you are, with labor and education for your motto, and justice and equal rights as your aim, you must succeed, and I know you will yet become equal to any people within the domain of the land, the home of all the oppressed of the earth," end quote. So at this 1869 convention, the charge was for education to be primary and success to be a part of it, but the aims were, of course, tied to justice. A number of these men attended that convention here in Louisville, and they went back home to Lexington. And they started the Colored Fair Association, or the Colored Fair Association, to pull together the resources of the community. And so it wasn't just this idea of having a fairground and having, you know, showing your vegetables and your livestock. The intent was to create an opportunity for them to generate not only commerce, but to solidify their community. So how many of you have been to a fair before? What do we sell at fairs? Everything, right? You make baskets, you make preserves, you show your calves, you show your, you know, your chickens, you show your the artisan, right? And you trade, you barter. So people are able to maintain a sense of dignity and develop pride at this Colored Fair Association, these different meetings. And so this lived on into the 1930s, the Colored Fair Association. Founded in 1869, lived on to the 1930s. And I think Shelby County had one, Jessamine County had one, but eventually they all kind of filtered into Lexington and shared in that environment. So it's very impressive. So that community, to go along with the Colored Fair Association, you had Pleasant Green Baptist Church, which was part of one of the oldest churches in the state of Kentucky. It started out as African Baptist Church, or the African Church, and over time it changed. Well, Murphy would have attended Pleasant Green Baptist Church based on where they lived, based on the census data. And so by the time he's old enough to start writing, there are different circumstances that happen, and this is this document here is Friedman's bank document. On this document, you have America Burns writing her name right there, Isaac Murphy's mother. It's giving her age, where they lived, her mother and father, her siblings. Down here talks about Isaac Murphy's her son, and only person who's going to draw from this account will be her. Well, funny thing happens, and it's not so funny, of course. The Friedman Bank, it fails. And America, who also owned property, she was something else. I'll put it to you that way. There was a gentleman in Lexington by the name of Ferdinand Smith, and he was a mattress maker. And he had been in Lexington since the 1850s. Somehow they know each other. But he has signed off on a number of these deeds for these different pieces of property that America would acquire. Well, she has assets now, and with the Freedman's Bank tanking, all of her assets are basically gone. Really, no one was able to recover the monies lost by the Freedman's Bank, very few people, and the former slaves were the least of those who were able to recover their monies. I also find out that J.T. Williams, who was one of the stable owners and who raced horses, talks about when Isaac comes to him, it's because his mother, right here it says right there, that she had become very sick with tuberculosis. So she was consumptive. She was sick. She was broke. And she had this little boy who had very long arms and, you know, for his age and was very small, what was going to happen to him. So she apprentices Isaac Murphy off to help not only take care of himself, but the money she earned from his apprenticeship, she helped her survive because she could not draw from her savings anymore. I also find out in Eli Jordan, who was the trainer that would groom Murphy, he said the same thing. His mother had become a consumptive and wanted him to have a life. So she rather have him become a jockey than to be some kind of a waif on the street. So it's not by, you know, one day we say, here, Isaac, you're going to be a jockey, go race. His mother was dying, and she wanted to find him an occupation so he would not become, you know, and don't forget, if you understand this history too, that vagrancy laws, what would happen to children if they were orphaned? Well, they would be sent to prison, and it was really like going to a hemp house where they were making rope, and so that was one way to prevent that from happening. In the Rise section of the book, this really talks about the grooming of Isaac Murphy and what it took to be a successful jockey. So working as a stable boy, working as an exercise boy, and eventually being able to ride as a jockey, being selected to ride as a jockey. In different accounts, especially coming from Eli Jordan, he would talk about Isaac being up in the stables, you know, being with the horses, being available when he needed to be. This also was where he learned the art of pace. He studied horses. He could tell you what a horse could do on an empty stomach, on a full stomach, early in the morning, late in the afternoon. He was very, very smart. He was very smart. And so in 1875, of course, is when he is turns professional. He rides in Louisville that inaugural year for the Kentucky Derby, but doesn't ride a derby that year. He rides in the very last race of the day, and he takes last place. But he does have a race over that inaugural meet. So here's a controversy as well. So you'll find different historians who cover horse racing and look at Murphy, and they'll say, well, no, he didn't have a 44% winning rate. He was more like 34%. Well, if you follow Murphy and you see and you recognize his strong sense of integrity, again, I don't have his papers. I wish I did. But in my gut, I'm thinking he has a ledger where he's written down what horse it was, where did he place, how much did he make from that race. Because he's taking care of his business, and it seems that he would be that diligent. He would be that academic in his approach to his racing. I just, somewhere someone has this. I know it. I just don't know where yet. 1883, this picture appears in the Kentucky Livestock newspaper, which really is the introduction of Murphy to a larger public. Those who go to Saratoga, owners like E.J. Baldwin, Ed Corrigan, they know Murphy. They've seen him race. And when he has a chance to start racing for J.W. Hunt Reynolds, who is the Frankfurt, also one of the founders of the Lexington Club, or the Louisville Club here, he really comes into his own. Here's some of the owners. Again, finding pictures of people. How many of you heard of J.W. Hunt Reynolds? Yeah. Well, that's him right there. I think I might have one of only two pictures of him. I believe there's one at the M.I. King Library as a young man, but no one has identified it yet. But if you put the pictures next to one another, that's the picture of him. It's not on there, but I guarantee you that is him. And this is his wife, Meta. E.J. Baldwin, Santa Anita, Hagen, there he goes, Ben Ali Hagen, that's it. And then Ed Corrigan. And Ed Corrigan, of course, was the bitter Irishman who was hailing himself out of Kansas City. But he and Murphy were on speaking terms, but Murphy would eventually leave him because he was very gruff. He was a rough man. Lucy Murphy, beautiful woman. She was born in 1868 in Frankfort, Kentucky, in the Crawfish Bottom. She has had a very interesting life after, Murphy's, not his death, but when we think about Murphy, we have a tendency not to really think about how she influences everyday life, his existence, his ability to succeed. There are different newspaper clippings where I'm finding T. Thomas Fortune, who was the editor of the New York Age, talk about how lovely she is and how she was always there to support him and how she almost faints when he, you know, starts a race because she is not sure he's going to survive. But he also is very clear, this is T. Thomas Fortune, that the way in which Murphy carries himself is reinforced by how she carries herself. And so they have this kind of, they feed off of one another. They're known to throw parties at their home in Lexington. They're good friends with William Walker, the great jockey who won a Kentucky Derby. Also, Anthony Hamilton's a good friend. They host these different wedding parties for them. At the end of Murphy's life, Lucy has, I want to say, there was about $30,000 that he left to her in his will. And, you know, it is kind of, an urban myth, or it hasn't been corroborated yet, but it's said that she rented a carriage, and on the anniversary of his death, she would take fresh flowers out to his gravesite. But what I also have heard is that whenever the flowers would wilt, she would always order a new bouquet. And so the $30,000 that was left to her in the will quickly diminished into nothing. And she worked. She dies in 1910, and she was working as a domestic up until that point. She loses the house on 3rd Street, which was identified as a mansion. And you'll see these records, and I think that happens in 1900. But Lucy is someone who I think we need to know more about. And then again, we're back to Isaac Murphy. This quote, "An Elegant Specimen of Manhood," is really the impetus behind the work. So how was he this elegant specimen of manhood? Not just that, who was the example, or who, can we say, identified these qualities as something to be explored and adopted. And so Walter Vosborough, the dean of horse racing and sports journalism, elevated Murphy to a position rarely held by black jockeys of the day. In the pages of the Spirit of the Times, Vosborough wrote dotingly about Isaac, calling him the quintessential jockey and gentleman, an elegant specimen of manhood to be recognized and applauded for his example in the saddle, in and out. The 23-year-old, whose life must have felt somewhat unreal and unfamiliar, continued to blossom. And so he was just beginning to really take form and shape. And so also in the 1880s, these tobacco cards started to be produced. You know, tobacco, Kentucky, Virginia, I mean, you know, goes together. But horse racing also was part of that. A number of these horse racing owners and breeders grew tobacco. It goes together. Murphy appears on 5 different cards, 3 alone with his likeness. The other 2 were on horseback, an Emperor of Norfolk and then also Los Angeles, owned by E.J. Baldwin. He was also on some of these other printed materials that emphasize the significance of particular horses and jockeys. So he's becoming not only a very successful jockey on the track, he's becoming a very popular jockey in the general public. Some of his friends, again, you may recall some of these, friends and rivals, rather, Anthony Hamilton, Willie Sims, and William Walker, and then his chief rivals, of course, were Snapper Garrison, Ed Snapper Garrison, and then James McLaughlin. Salvatore versus Tenney, the famous race, right? The controversy here, of course, is here. The controversy is that people believe that Isaac Murphy was a showman, right? That he would hold races off and try to win by nose just to bring some kind of, you know, nervousness to the crowd. When in fact, if you listen to him, he's quoted several times saying this, that it's about winning. It's about winning. So he wasn't interested necessarily in beating a horse. So Ed Garrison would whip a horse until it bled, of course, and would he would spur it on. Murphy would try to go ahead and take a horse across the line with just enough to win. And so this first photo finish that John Hemmett took in 1890 is recognized as the first photo finish, which also gives us an idea of Murphy's style. If you get a chance to get up close or see the picture in the book, you'll see he's looking over at Garrison, and he's sitting up tall in his saddle, and the horse wins by a nose. His guts, I would say yes. He is a showman, but he's very confident in what he's doing. And then there are, I want to say, six of these types of lithographs of, you know, that try to portray or represent this race. It's another thing I've been doing is collecting these lithographs and, you know, trying to get some of this as primary evidence. Because again, if I go back, you know, these types of images are very rare. They're very rare. And so I'm finding them in really obscure places, like in Nebraska and, you know, Iowa. The value is really not known. Revelations. And again, I'm trying to give you overviews of what you'll find in the research. The Revelations portion of the book is dealing with the reality of how America is changing. 1870s, 1880s were very good to black jockeys. There was something that they were able to take advantage of because they were groomed to do this during slavery, and coming directly out of it, they were the experts. They were the people that had the qualities and the skills that the owners could take advantage of. But as the horse racing changes, especially the latter part of the 80s and into the 90s, when gambling becomes a really big part of it, especially in New York in the Northeast, and you're no longer having 3 to 5 races in a day, now you're having 10 to 20 in a day, and they're running, you know, half mile, three-quarter mile heats, or even a mile, trying to get as much gambling in a day as possible over a 20 to 30 day period, the money gets so good that these black jockeys are being excluded from some of the races. And the jockeys that are colluding are generally the Irish jockeys, not to, you know, it's not this idea of Irish versus white. It's that these Irish jockeys that are being trained by Father Daly in New York, who runs this orphanage for boys, is grooming these kids in a way that they purposely want to keep these jockeys from winning. And so you don't have to kick a guy into a rail to make him lose. You can box him in so he can never get out to run the race. And if you're working together, you choose who's going to win that race, everyone wins. So what you're finding, and there are different narratives where, you know, a guy like Anthony Hamilton, who I showed you a picture of, he would say, they're boxing me in, I couldn't get out. Well, he can't race anymore because he's not a successful jockey. It used to be where people were, you know, the jockeys especially ran honest races. Now, they may have an occasion where a jockey's going to pull a horse and not win a race when it can win a race so it can make more money from gambling, but rarely would you have them boxing each other in because it was still the integrity of the race. Everyone wanted to finish. And so these types of images started to be produced around the mid to late 1880s. You know, more or less, you know, they were not these images here. Dignified. They became more caricature of the black jockeys. And so I'm exploring that in the book in ways that really try to ask questions about what's happening in America and why is this idea of competition not a true sense of competition, but you have to figure out ways in which to, you know, tie a guy down before you can decide to run a race against him. a slow descent. So by 1895, Murphy is pretty much out of horse racing. And 1894, Sporting News, you guys know that newspaper, right? The founder of Sporting News decided he wanted to become a playwright, so Al Spink. So Al Spink, he writes this play called The Derby Winner. And Freeland, the horse that was owned by Ed Corrigan, he gets him before he goes to, you know, for lack of a better explanation, the glue factory, and he incorporates Freeland into this play. He also recruits Isaac Murphy to be in this play. So you know where former athletes or actors go on a vaudeville circuit? This is now what Murphy is doing in 1894. So he's at the end of his racing career. I mean, again, 1894, I think he had, 1895, he had one race. He was in 20 races and he won two. And 1894, he basically has stopped racing. The image over here is him on horseback, and that's his property line right there. His house was butted up right next to the Lexington track, and so he could see the track from the back of his house. And on different occasions, he would invite friends over to come see the races at the Lexington Association races. You have the certificate of death and the funeral notice at his passing. 500 people attended his funeral. Probably what's most significant about this is that, you know, on the day he dies, he was part of the Masons. He was the keeper of values for the Masons. And you have all these people, white and black, coming out to say their goodbyes. Owners were sending, different owners from across the country, E.J. Baldwin, Ed Corrigan, his friends show up to be pallbearers. And so, you know, on this cold February day, February 16th, 1896, he's buried in African Cemetery Number 2. But that was not the end of Murphy. It would take, less than 100 years before, in 1955, when he's inducted into the National Horse Racing Hall of Fame, a story to be published that he was actually buried in Alabama that would actually resurrect Murphy. And thank goodness for Frank Borries, who was working at the Lexington Herald, who got this story off the wire and said, that's not true. Isaac Murphy is buried here in Kentucky, in Lexington. By this time, the headstone that marked where he was buried was gone, but there were a few people still alive who remember where it was at. And so I'm very fortunate that Frank Borries started doing this research back in 1955, and his wife continued the work after that, after he passed away, because these types of documents, they're now at Keeneland, and they were given to Keeneland by Frank Borries. Now, I could not tell you where they would have ended up. I mean, I can't even guess. But if Frank Borries had not started doing this work in the garbage somewhere, what's that?
It would have ended up at the Filson Society.
You think so? In 1955, I don't know. You know, who was interested in Isaac Murphy? Frank Borries did an excellent job, and his wife did as well. These are the shreds. These are the bits of evidence that I've been winnowing through, that I actually worked with to be able to, you know, give you what I have here today. But there's so much more research to be done. And I just hope I provided at least some kind of direction for the next researcher to pull this thing apart and, you know, think about, how, the mercantilism of the age kind of influenced not just horse racing, but, you know, city layouts. You know, when I'm thinking about the 3rd Street in Jefferson, where they had this meeting in 1869, I was there today. I walked from the Galt House, and I said, okay, it was right here. But I'm not sure people probably looked at me like, what is this guy doing? But I was right in the same place where they had this meeting, you know, a while ago. And I do the same thing when I go to Lexington. I walk around Lexington remembering, okay, the church was over here, the house was over here, it's no longer there, but there are, you know, traces in the different places of where these stories unfolded. And it becomes an adventure. And I had a great time working on this book. And the next book I'm working on is a book about Anthony Hamilton, who was a good friend of Isaac Murphy's. And he died in Italy in 1904. And so you have this exodus of black jockeys. Jimmy Wingfield, of course, leaves and goes to Russia and races for the Tsar. And then when World War I breaks out, he goes to Paris and then finds his way back to the United States. Willie Sims is the first American jockey to win an American horse at the Epsom races in 1895, I believe. And so these jockeys are leaving America to go race overseas where they actually have a chance to win and compete. So I'm interested in that. You know, I'm interested in getting the Fulbright to go to Italy, really, is what I'm interested in. And so... That was Jimmy Wingfield. Yeah, Jimmy Wingfield. Spoke French, Russian, Italian, yes. That was Wingfield. And Ed Hodling, I can't forget Ed Hodling. Anyone's read The Great Black Jockeys or Wink, Ed Hodling has, you know, he passed away earlier this year, so did Ann Butler. These are people in my mentor who I have owe a debt to because they did work that I was able to really kind of borrow from and kind of spring forward. And I think that we don't do that enough. We don't pay homage to those who allow for us to do the things that we do, especially historians. So I'm going to end my talk and open up for questions right now.
You mentioned that Isaac Murphy was the first inductee into the Hall of Fame, the Museum and Hall of Fame of Racing. And there was only one other black jockey, if I recall. Was that Jimmy Wingfield?
It's Wingfield and Hamilton. Hamilton got inducted this year. Okay. Anthony Hamilton.
What kind of a relationship, if any, did Wingfield and Isaac Murphy have?
Well, he was a boy growing up when Isaac was racing. So he would have probably seen him. And like William Walker, you know, these jockeys are pretty tight. I mean, I think especially those that understand their responsibility. William Walker is teaching Isaac Murphy how to run races, just like Eli Jordan was teaching him how to think about a horse, or even Ansel Williamson was grooming Ed Brown, who becomes a great trainer at one point. So, it's hard for me to imagine that here's this boy, and so in the book, The Black Maestro, Joe Drape writes about how Jimmy Wingfield's looking, he's at the Kentucky Association races looking at Isaac Murphy, you know, train, and he's on the fence, running on the fence, watching the horses run, he's running along the fence. So you have these connections with these different, you know, jockeys who are handing down and across these different ways in which to think about themselves as jockeys. Murphy would invite people like Anthony Hamilton and William Walker to his home, along with Willie Sims, and with the, you know, this idea of how to race. And so there's this famous recorded statement that, you know, Murphy would tell these guys, you know, be honest, don't pull your horse, you'll get more mounts that way. If you're known as a dishonest jockey, people will know that and you won't get the opportunities. And so he is really doling out this philosophy about how to be successful and how to maintain where you're at. And some of them adhere to it. I think Willie Sims does, and I think Anthony Hamilton does. But Anthony Hamilton, I want to say it was in 1894, he was riding in a race, and he was accused of pulling his horse, and the judges, they exclude him. And the jockey club is now kicking into full gear, too, and they exclude him. But the owners actually argue on his behalf. He's riding for August Belmont. And so he argues on his behalf, and he's reinstated and is able to race again. But, you know, these forces were working against these guys, and, you know, they were successful, and for the most part, they were just trying to be good jockeys. Yes, sir?
The community of African-American athletes today, how well known is
I had Joe Lewis Barrel Jr. on campus last night at Emory. We just opened a new exhibition on Joe Lewis's father. This is 100th birthday is coming up next May. So he asked me, Joe Lewis Jr., what are you working on? I said, I just finished my book on Isaac Murphy. He goes, you did a book on Isaac Murphy? And what's his name? Joe Barry Carroll, who was a basketball player in the 80s and 90s, said, well, who is that? And so Joe Barrel Jr. is, you know, wow, you know. So I guess it's generational. It's generational. So I could talk to someone like Willie Lanier, and he would know who Joe Lewis, or he would know who Isaac Murphy was because he learned about Isaac Murphy early on. Whereas if I talk to someone, a contemporary athlete, not a clue. Horse racing is a different sport also, but, you know, is he a hero? Should he be? I think that's a different set of questions. Surely there are other questions for me. Yes?
I have a question about the process.
Yes?
You said that you're pulling together all these fragments and you're picking things up in Nebraska and Iowa. How did you start and how did
So, I'm like a Discovery Channel nerd, right? And actually, Stephen Hawking is one of my favorite people to read and also kind of listen to. And so he's talking one day about his research and ideas about black holes, right? And he says, you know, we know they exist because of the effect that they have on the things around it. And that's when I had my aha moment. So I know Murphy exists, not just because he was a great jockey and we've recorded, but I also know that there are people around him who are having an effect on him. So I kind of invert that kind of, you know, that theory. And so I start looking for people like, you know, L.P. Tarleton, who was a lawyer in Lexington, who when J.W. Hunt Reynolds dies in 1879, in 1880, Isaac Murphy's mother dies in 79, he marries Meta. And so L.P. Tarleton has a history, so I'm tracking his history, his biography. And then I do the same thing with J.W. Hunt Reynolds. Who is he? Where does he come from? And so as I start looking for these other people, I'm finding evidence about Murphy. And it's just a simple thing like Isaac Murphy was at the farm today. Or, you know, Murphy comes to a hotel to receive award. Just looking for different names. And so slowly but surely, just by looking in the periphery, I'm finding that there's more information connected to these other people than it is directly to Murphy. So it's, you know, the image of Lucy Murphy at the Kentucky Historical Society is in the T.T. Wendell file. Why it's in the T.T. Wendell file, I have no clue. But that one picture leads me to a Polaroid in the box of a silver trophy with an M inscribed on it in this velvet case. They may have the papers I'm looking for. And it may be, it's a Polaroid, so that means it was in the 70s, potentially the 80s. So other family members may have materials. And so I'm pulling and looking for threads. And, you know, everything has to be, you know, exhausted as evidence. And Red Bank, New Jersey. Why is that important, right? Well, I had to figure out where Lucy and Isaac would stay when they would travel to New York or Brooklyn. Red Bank, New Jersey had this really nice, stable black population. And they lived in these little cottages on the river. So Murphy gets sick. There's a doctor in Red Bank, New Jersey that pops up in a newspaper article. I look for this doctor. I found out where he is. And it connected this other story about Murphy being sick. So it's like you try to find these other ways in which to kind of give you what you're looking for. It's like being an anthropologist or an ethnographer, right? You're just there, and you're just waiting for it. Because if you go with a kind of narrow set of questions, you're going to miss some of the evidence that actually give you what you're looking for, what you think you're looking for, if anything. So it's just trial and error, and just collect everything, and then at some point, it'll all come together.
I'll be surprised if the publication of the book doesn't open
yes.
more doors.
Yes.
You may find that ledger
yet. I'm looking. I am always looking because it just does. For me, it doesn't make any sense to you know. I said earlier that I was looking for his voice. I really was. I was looking in every newspaper article I could find. I wanted to hear him say what he was thinking, what he was doing, how he responded. Because these reporters were asking really tough questions. You know, did you try to win by a nose? You know, I was just trying to win. That's what I get paid for, is to win. Are you your own man? Of course I am. I have a contract to ride for Mr. Corrigan, and that's how I ride. So, I mean, he's answering these questions so clearly, but then it changes when they start adding this dialect, this, you know, kind of southern rural vernacular that previously they didn't record. And so something is happening with the press at the same time. And so I'm having to really do this kind of work, understanding, okay, what's happening? So around 1893, how they're recording Anthony Hamilton publicly giving a response to, you know, losing a close race, it changes from when they recorded him in 1888. Here in 88, he's very articulate. So are they cleaning it up in 88 and then recording it as it actually is in 94? Or is it just vice versa? So, I mean, there are all these different questions, you know, that keep popping up. But I think that ledger is out there. I just have a feeling. One more question. Yes.
Theater on Isaac Murphy.
I have no, no, and no. I'll tell you why. When I was doing this work, I had a number of people trying to have me read different books. I didn't want to have any influence. I wanted to just go at this raw. I didn't want to, you know, have Frank X. Walker, who wrote the play, I think. He has this book on, I Dedicate This Ride. It was a book of poems. And he has reconstructed the world that Murphy and America and Lucy lived in. I didn't want to have that. I just wanted to go look at the evidence and try to craft something based on what I found. That was one of the things that, like reading Joe Drape's book on Jimmy Wingfield, I cringed the whole time because, you know, it's hard to think about how do you write about horse racing, because it's not always about the race. It's about the preparation for the race. It's about the silks. It's about the pomp. It's all these other things that make the races important. The 2.5 minutes, you know, if it's a long race, is going to be there. But what is it about that environment? And I was stubborn. 30 more seconds. So Ralph Ellison, the great writer of Invisible Man, he says in an interview that, you know, we can choose our literary ancestors. We can choose who we want to, you know, follow as it relates to being writers. And I've had the fortunate opportunity to get to know Arnold Rampersad, who is his biographer. And he is very clear when he says that, you know, that quote I have about our job is to provide an opportunity to look at these individuals and be able to write in a way that is clearly indicative of how they would have responded to different stimuli in different situations. I thought if I would have read anything by anyone else, that I would have had that in the back of my head the whole time, but I would have been fighting against it to kind of represent them, my protagonists, in a way that was not really the way in which they would have responded in those different moments. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.